Thank you.
Jay Guru, everybody, welcome to minute five of the Awake the Life of Yogananda podcast. My name is Mike, and I'm here, as always, with Priyank and with Chris. How are you guys doing today? Priyank, how was your morning meditation?
Very good, thank you. Today, just ended a short fasting period, so like I was eager to finish the meditation and start eating, but I finished it.
Nice.
I'm good. It's in Northern Ireland. It's quite funny at the minute. It's snowing heavily today, and it was quite a thick layer of snow, and then now it's all gone because it's sunny again. But yeah, the morning meditation was good. Connected me to master the first thing in the morning, and really teed me up well for the day.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm not in Spain anymore now. I'm back in Vienna. And yesterday it was pretty warm, and today it went to like hailing. So it's like weather is everywhere.
It's not just me in Northern Ireland.
No. Yeah.
I'm disappointed. I think my plants might die. -4 for us last night.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, my garden plants, my vegetables.
All that work. All the vegetables.
As in, like, some of the vegetables, I'm sure they can't handle the, because they're all still saplings, can't handle that frostbite.
Yeah. It's an unusual time of year to have that. Fingers crossed, we'll pray for them. We'll keep the vegetables in mind.
For sure. So let's talk about minute five of the podcast. It continues from last time. And now there is someone talking about Yogananda. His name is Professor Hitendra Wadhwa. Am I saying this correctly?
Yep,
And he's mentioning Steve Jobs, and you see a picture of Steve Jobs, and he basically says that Steve Jobs had only one book on his iPad, famously. It was the autobiography of a yogi. I didn't know who Hitendra Wadhwa was before. Have you guys heard of him before? Chris, have you heard of him before?
Yeah, so he actually has quite an interesting background himself. So he's essentially in the practice of mentorship and coaching, and he really he has his own company, so you can go on to mentora.institute and check him out there. So he talks a lot about being at the intersection of spirituality and materiality between the East and the West, which, you know, as anybody knows from Yogananda's teachings, is exactly what Yogananda does as well. So he's obviously been, I would imagine, either influenced by Yogananda or just on the same spiritual path as Yogananda. You should really check his stuff out. So he talks about how, you know, simple yet profound insights that success in life and leadership originates from within, and has led to the training and transformation of thousands of executives worldwide. So that's what he does. So it's spiritual first, and then material work and life second. So pretty cool guy.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, cool.
Pretty relevant for you, Chris, in your line of business, I'm sure.
I can actually share something there. It wasn't really until spirituality aspect of my life took off that, you know, my career took off, and, you know, various things in my life took off. You know, my partner Barbara came to me through a spiritual pull through magnetism that way, and I would wholeheartedly agree with what he's doing. I don't know if you guys have the same experience, but for me, for sure,
most certainly. In the book, Awake book, it says he is a professor of professional practice at Columbia University Business School and a founder of the Institute of Personal Leadership. Dr. Hitendra Wadhwa's research and teachings focus on how to maximize one's outer impact through inner mastery. It draws on universal laws of human nature that are validated by the latest scientific research and exemplified by the lives of great leaders. And then finally, it says his work has been inspired by the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. So I'm sure somewhere, he's somewhere down the line, he's somehow a devotee.
Yeah.
Looking at his picture, he looks very serene, doesn't he? When he's speaking, he's like very grounded. Like he's obviously quite eminent in his field, but he looks very grounded and he looks like someone you really would love to have a cup of tea with, right?
Yeah. Like he does, he teaches at Columbia's most popular MBA leadership class and personal leadership and success. So he basically teaches the like driving strategic impact, leading from the inside out. So it's, yeah, if you're in need of any strategic insight, that's the guy to go to, apparently.
I think that's so great. I feel like leadership and spirituality goes together so well, right? So.
Well, it's funny, just before we started recording, we were actually talking essentially about this, right? Mm-hmm. So we were talking about the state of careers in the world and how we're constantly looking to work and improve and iterate upon technology and how that influences us by working 60, 70 hours a week, whereas we don't really need to. And maybe if we got the spirituality aspect right, as humanity, what would the world look like? You know, how much would we work in the week, and you know, would we have more time for meditation and different things that maybe we should have time for? So quite apt. We were talking about that before the call, actually.
We did. There's definitely a balance to strike there. And now we can finally start talking about my favorite subject, about Steve Jobs, even though it's just a small mention in the movie. But when I saw this, I remember myself.
What does he mention, Hitendra Wadia? What does he actually say? I think I've got it here, actually, in the script.
Yeah.
He says, Steve Jobs apparently had only one book on his iPad. Lo and behold, that book turns out to be Autobiography of a Yogi. Yes. And then we see a picture of Steve Jobs, like, well, I think there's Mac computers in the really old, like, Mac computers in the background. And he's got his, like, thinking. He's like, he's scratching his chin, like, and his legs are up. It's quite a cool picture. Virtually the same length as mine and Chris's is right now.
It looks a lot like George Harrison in that picture, I think.
Oh yeah, true that.
Yeah.
I suppose it's that era, isn't it?
He was a bit of a hippie, right?
Yeah, Steve definitely. Jobs.
Like I remember when he passed away, his biography came out, Walter Isaacson, and there were so many stories about him and being a hippie. Like he did so many funny things. Like at Apple, he was banning all the soda machines, for example. And there's this company called Odwalla that makes like juices. And he would only allow people to buy juice from Odwalla in his office and no Coke, for example.
That's amazing. I love him even more now. Something I would do.
Yeah, he took it to some extremes. Like, I don't think all of it was good and healthy, but some of it was very inspiring. And at some point in the 70s, he went to India and he wanted to meet the same guy who was actually Krishna Das guru, like Neem Karoli Baba.
Ah, nice time.
And he was looking him up, but when he got there, he only heard that he already had passed away. Wow. So he didn't. And he stayed in a hotel that, like, I think the hotel he booked was already full or something. And then he stayed in a hotel that wasn't so great. And they told him he could drink the tap water, and then he got super ill. Yeah, he got ill, and then some family somewhere took care of him, and basically nurtured him back to health. And they had like in their bookshelf, they had the Autobiography of a Yogi there, and that's how he found it. That was his story that he mentioned in his biography, which I found super interesting.
And there's
there's so many anecdotes. Do you want to share one, Chris, about Steve Jobs?
I mean, I think the thing I can share really was he was probably, there was a rip through Steve Jobs that really got me into the SRF. I might have shared this story before, but I'll share it again. When I was watching in 2016, I think it was November or something, a documentary on Steve Jobs. And it was the one with Michael Fassbender. And it was great, you know, and I was paying attention to the spiritual aspect to the documentary. And I just thought to myself, like, here's a guy who's really trying to search for perfection or simplicity. And I like the idea of that because it kind of spoke to me that he was doing more than, you know, just trying to make a bit of technology or something. You know, he was really striving for something, you know, close to the spiritual realm. And I was mentioning this to a friend of mine over dinner. And he in turn said, oh, well, did you know that at his funeral, he gave away 500 copies of the Autobiography of a Yogi to the 500 people that, you know, attended the funeral? And I said, no, like, what's this book? And he told me a little bit about it. But as we were talking, you could feel the electricity in the air. You know, I've never once felt it. I had no idea what it was. And he asked me about, you know, do you have any sensation here? And I was literally on fire. You know, my pineal gland, it was my third eye, you know, was on fire, basically, when he was telling me the story. And I've never really since had that experience. So it was so profound to be sitting in a London, you know, Japanese restaurant, having this experience that I didn't know anything about yoga. I didn't know anything about spirituality, really. And this was the conversation that really took hold of me, I would say, really took hold of me and put me on this path for Yogananda and, you know, through the Autobiography of a Yogi. And I have Steve Jobs to thank and this friend of mine to thank for it as well.
That is so interesting. So basically, through Steve Jobs, you found Guruji.
Yeah. So I've got a real soft spot for Steve Jobs. I know he was probably pretty hard to work with, but, you know, definitely have a soft spot for Steve Jobs.
Well, that's a phenomenal story. Interesting you mentioned hard to work with. Like, I was listening to another podcast called How I Built This and they're talking about the founder of, the founder from Dropbox was talking. Dropbox is, as you guys are probably aware of, they were the first to do like file sharing via cloud and make it really accessible and easy. And the founder was saying that they started growing a little bit, and then Steve Jobs just called him and said, like, listen, come and meet with me. And this is about 20 years ago or so. And they had a meeting, and he said, listen, I really like your product. This is Steve Jobs saying, I really like your product. You know, you made it really good. You know, it fits with the ethos with a lot of the things that we're trying to do at Apple. But let me tell you about your problems and why you won't grow. And he listed like 5 to 10 different things about what his problems were. And the guy took away from that is either you get absorbed into Apple, i.e. we buy you out. You're saying we're going to buy you out, or we're going to build our own Dropbox, and they end up doing that iCloud, and Microsoft have got their own, you know, OneDrive, etc. And you'll be drowned out of the market. And, you know, so and we're talking about leadership here. You know, there's you know, to create Apple, you know, such a biggest company in the world, isn't it? You can't just be like you're in a war, right? You're in your own little battle of Kurukshetra. Like, I was reading this in the Gita today, actually, like, even in the land of business, like, you're in a mini war, and you can't afford to be like a nice guy, right?
Yeah, totally. Yogananda talks about that in one of the lessons, essentially, like, just because you're doing yoga and just because you're on the path of spirituality doesn't mean that you don't stand up for yourself. You know, you don't fight your corner. I know other big names were drawn to Yogananda. You know, Elvis Presley was one of the famous ones. But in business world, the entrepreneur George Eastman, who founded Kodak, mm-hmm. It was there, and opera singer Amelita Galli-Kerseum. Totally butchering the pronunciation, but
I think she's coming later, isn't she, in the book?
She's coming later in the book. Yeah. So there's a lot of big names, like even US President Calvin Coolidge invited Yogananda to the White House at the time. So for a personal audience. So, you know, he drew a lot of influential people and I'm sure influenced them in ways that maybe they didn't even recognize. And Steve Jobs, it was said that, I was doing some research on this on Kiora.com. It was said that Steve Jobs, when he came back from India, he took more chances. So he actually decided to, you know, to go out into the world and take risks. I suppose his ideas of the West were changed after going to the East. And so upon his return, he you know, really motivated him to form what became Apple. So really, like, the scope of influence that this book has had is kind of hard to measure in some sense. It isn't immeasurable, really. But I would love to really kind of sit down and start chat to Steve, because he only had that book on his iPad. Like, you know, he read it, he reread it since 1970s, you know, every year. So
should we listen to his voice there? Because I've got a very nice snippet from in 2005 when he went to his old school in Stanford University. He did a commencement address for the new graduates. Very nice bit, and we mentioned spirituality. So he talked about like, you know, what makes success, and he mentioned in his speech, like, it's a very famous speech. It's had like 37 million views, and you'll find it straight away on YouTube. And like, he starts off and he says, like, things like, you know, I didn't actually graduate, I dropped out. And then the beauty of that is, like, I still stayed in the college, but I just went to lectures that I wanted to attend. And then he said, and from that, I gained and drew inspiration so much. And then all of a sudden, he switches into this. Listen.
When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
Amazing. Wow, what a speaker, right?
It's just chills when I hear this, because I feel like a lot of us have this kind of feeling inside, like you have this dream that you kind of want to manifest in your life, right? But I might do it tomorrow, or first I do this, then I do that, you know? And this is just such pure passion for what is the right thing that you should do, that it's very inspiring. I feel like this kind of passion that manifested in his work as well. I, like you guys mentioned earlier, that he was difficult to work with. Like, I heard he worked his engineers to death, basically. He made them work super long hours. He got obsessed about little details and changed them back and forth and everything. But he really cared, right? He really, really cared. Like, he was not the kind of CEO that comes in, is CEO for 3-4 years and then gets a package and gets out again. Like, he really cared. He thought this as this whole company that he built as his tool and as a workshop, and he wants to build something amazing. And I feel like this is the kind of passion that you kind of need to have in life to do the things that you came here to do. So that's why I find it really inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely somebody who was striving. What was it, Priyanka was saying, how there's different types of paths on yoga. Mm. One was the intellectual path, right?
Jnana yoga, yeah.
Yanni. Yeah. So yeah, whenever I look at him, I think he's probably a guy with 160 IQ, you know, and he's just striving to bring something, you know, that's probably closer, like to get us closer to some like telepathic communication or something. I don't know, to some pure spiritual form of the only two realities that exist is consciousness and thought. And like the simplicity of an iPhone, it's kind of one small step towards, you know, this more pure living, if that's not too much of an exaggeration or stretch. I think he's a pretty special guy.
And you'll note that he said he compared like death, like this is your last, you know, if I'm not doing thing, if I'm doing something that you could die any day, basically. And it's interesting that, you know, we're talking about awake, because Yogananda says, like, when you sit down to meditate, what does your ego say? Like, oh, I've got this to do, I've got that to do, I'll have a long meditation tomorrow, right? But listen to what he's saying, you have to, today is, you could die any day, tomorrow may never be, right? And listen to the chant, wake yet wake, oh my saint. Listen to the words, like it says, oh my saint, wake yet wake, oh my saint, you did not meditate, you did not concentrate, and pass thy time in idle words. Oh my saint, wake yet wake, oh my saint, death will be at thy door, and you may not have time anymore to redeem thy soul. Oh my saint, wake yet wake. So it's in the words, right? It's in our jingle that we played on the guitar just for this, and it's in beautifully expressed through Steve Jobs. So, you know, he said he heard that saying, and who would have bet that it may have even been from a passage from Yogananda's writings, right, that inspired him in this way. And how much influence has he had, and Apple had, through the development of the world, right? And you know, and you talk about the 21st century, if you don't talk about Apple, then you haven't completed a good discourse in the history of and how technology has influenced the world, does it?
Yeah, he's definitely one of the greatest technological thinkers of our time, right? Him and Bill Gates kind of had that famous kind of competition between the two of them. So he's up there for sure.
But he's a manifester, I feel like, because I feel like the technologies that he used, they were kind of there already. And there might have been other people who had those same kind of ideas, but he was a manifester. He sought those ideas, he took them together, and he made it happen in really, really quickly as well. Like, there was one day, I remember back then, there were like phones, there were Blackberries, there were all those kind of things that even had touch screens, but it wasn't like everyone had one of those. And suddenly the iPhone came out, and now everyone needed to have a smartphone, basically, from one year to the next. And that is like a lot of focused concentration and power that he put in to get this kind of result out.
Yeah. Do we know, did he say or do anything else? Because to my mind, you know, it's a good find, Priyank, on the video recording of the speech he did. But do we know that, did he mention it anywhere else about spirituality or about Yogananda? Because I couldn't really find too much more. Because to me, it's quite interesting that it was like clearly quite influential on him that he only had that book on his iPad. But he didn't really openly talk about it either. So
yeah.
What do you think the catch is?
I feel like in his autobiography, they didn't talk too much about spirituality either. But they did always say he was interested. So he read about Transcendental Meditation, which is a book a lot of people have read. He also said in the days when they were programming in their garage, that he didn't have any money. So he went to the Hare Krishna temple each day for lunch, and was a 1 hour walk and a 1 hour walk back. But they gave out free meals. I think I'm not sure if they still do that, but at the time that was something he was into. And I do think that he was always in this kind of realm of spiritual ideas, but more privately. On the other side, like he was into hallucinogens, right? So he said famously some he liked LSD apparently, and those kind of things. So it went that way as well.
Yeah. He was exploring.
Also, he's also running like one of the biggest companies in the world, right?
Yes. Well,
he's trying to make it the biggest company. And you generally do well by not talking about any specific religion, spirituality path. Like, you know, like that speech that I just said, like, us we can very easily see the spiritual basis behind that little section, that, but you know, and he's done it so subtly, right? Like anyone who's not even religious or spiritual can see. Actually, yeah, I know, I could get hit by a bus tomorrow, what am I doing today? And we can relate that to our lives in terms of, you know, our meditation and our practices, but the average Joe can be like, you know, their hopes and dreams and, you know, their duty in life. So I sense that he may have done it in a smart way, in the sense that he didn't openly say, you know,
your audience.
Yeah, I didn't, you know, he didn't openly promote one organization or one religious or spiritual path per se, but he kind of infused it in his speeches and his actions. Like if you think about, like, you know, if you look at his, he invented the Slack presentation. Like, you know, he always presented, even no matter who it was to, in that white polo neck and blue jeans, is that right? And since then, black polo neck and blue jeans, right? And since then, like, if you think of any tech company doing a presentation, no one does suits, do they? Like, if you're wearing a suit, you're obviously not cool, right? So he kind of invented that, like, get away from this corporate, like, life. He, no matter what he was doing, he was like minimalistic, and he was, you know, you could obviously afford the smartest possible suit, and his advisors would say, you know, probably would say, wear something formal, and be like, no, I'm doing my own thing. I've got my own style, and even in that dress, he, you know, it says like image is not as important as what you are, right, and what your ideas are and your own capabilities. So I feel like he showed his spirituality in subtle ways that actually has a more of an impact than, you know, the preachers that are out there that aim to endeavor to do that in this day and age.
There's something to be said as well, just maybe I don't want to dwell on Steve Jobs too much because we've got more to talk about, but it seemed to me that he maybe lived a life on the razor's edge. And that is something that I see in Yogananda, in a way, in spirituality. It is very much a razor's edge that you kind of walk along. And he really lived to that extreme. He was very much like a no-nonsense kind of guy. Like, and the way he spoke just cut to the core of every issue and every matter. And there was very little wastage, like you said, the minimalistic lifestyle and clothes and everything. It just seemed to me like there was very little waste and a very efficient way to live life. Yeah, very spiritual in that sense for me.
Yeah.
He kind of incorporates this kind of California spirit a little bit as well. I feel like that's why he became a kind of a cult figure. That kind of, should we move? Like, I could talk about Steve Jobs for another hour, I think, but
we could do a bonus Steve Jobs episode.
Welcome to the Steve Jobs podcast.
For sure. Let's move on to the next scene. So you then see a scene where it's like a large hall, it's people practicing yoga. And then you have this person called Masvidal talking, and he's saying, let me read it. He says, I'm reading basically your notes, but I can read them. Yep. Yoga for many has become something that you do with your body, but the yogis never taught that. The way that Yogananda taught yoga was use the body. You have a body, but it's really about the mind, expanding your consciousness. So what do we know about Masvidal and what did he mean by that?
I'll consult my book. The Masvidal is the director and founder of Dancing Shiva Yoga. Masvidal has been heavily influenced by the teachings and writings of Yogananda. An Ayurvedic practitioner, Mas travels extensively leading workshops and teacher trainings around the world. So I hadn't heard of him, first of all. Dancing Shiva Yoga, I've never heard of that either. Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, what yoga are they doing? What practices are they following? Is that
I believe it's like Hatha Yoga that they're doing. So I think they're probably in one part of Surya Namaskar.
Yeah, it looks very familiar. But I mean, what practices have you guys taken over the course of your life?
I mean, Hatha Yoga. I started really early, but I never got really good at it, unfortunately. It's like constantly lingering in my mind. Like, I should do more yoga. My flexibility, I would say, is mediocre. It's not as much fun as when you are really good at all the poses.
That's just hard work required.
Yeah, I do remember Priyank is really good at Hatha Yoga.
Wouldn't say good, but it's nearly half of my, more than half of my life, I suppose, I've been practicing. So 18 years, I've been practicing Hatha Yoga. So I remember when I was in university, there was a yoga temple, actually. It was not a studio. There was a temple near my house in Hounslow in West London. And they actually... It was a temple in that they had Divine Mother there and various other of the Hindu gods. And the only thing that the temple taught was Hatha Yoga. So it was a strange temple, actually, but I feel that I got taught in quite an authentic way. And like this image that we see of this like colossal studio that, there's, probably 500 people doing yoga in that kind of that almost repulses me and how yoga has become. And this is kind of what Masvidal is saying, right? Yoga has something to do with the body, but not everything. Mm-hmm. Use the body, you have a body, but it's really about the mind expanding your consciousness. So when I do yoga, it's really Hatha Yoga, it's really an internal process, like and I couldn't think of I couldn't think of doing that on mass instruction and that kind of that noisy environment. And it's like, imagine if you're trying to meditate in the middle of Times Square, it would be quite a hard thing to do, wouldn't it? That's my take. But I've been practicing for a good few years, and interestingly, when I first came to SRF, I've been doing Hatha Yoga before I started the lessons, and so I carried on doing Surya Namaskar. And when you apply for Kriya, you have an interview with one of the monks, and he'll ask you, okay, well, tell me about your routine, what are your practices, and I said, oh, I do Hatha Yoga every morning without fail, and then I sit to meditate. And he said, okay, before meditation, what do you do? Not do you have, you have to do energization. And I said, well, I feel like the Hatha Yoga I've been taught actually encapsulates a lot of the energization. And he said, no, it doesn't. you must do energization. And thankfully, he permitted me to take Kriya on the basis that for the next 3 to 6 months, I would make it religiously a part of my routine. And I have to this day, every single day I do energization. And I must say, like, I've heard Yogananda talk about this, and he says, like, if you do your energization properly, it's better. I'm quoting, it's better even than Hatha Yoga. And, the prana, the life control, and, that is what you're trying to achieve in Hatha Yoga, that stillness. And energization actually... we can't go into the details of the practice, but that's what enables you to achieve the same goals, and obviously in a more concentrated, refined, more deeper way than that's usually portrayed in Hatha Yoga styles, especially in what's shown in this image where it's 500 people and one announcer saying, do this pose, do that pose.
Everybody's doing something different.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah, there's one person meditating at the front. There's the, yeah, it's a bit crazy. One person
lined on. Yeah, I imagine like in a room that size, you know, it's, there's so much energy floating around and people releasing different things at different times. And yeah, it would be quite distracting in some ways. Good fun, I suppose. Look, you know, if you haven't done it before, get yourself to these kind of places, and you know, it's, you have to start somewhere. And I always find, like, so I first did asana yoga, this type of yoga. I did ashtanga for the first time for a 6-week course, a beginner's course in London. And it was fantastic. I don't think I've ever been in such a flow state in those times as when I was, when I was doing a form of yoga. So I was able to really work with my mind and the emotional body, and it was all, everything was coming into more of an aligned state. So yeah, definitely worth pursuing if you haven't done it before.
Very nice. The thought that comes to my mind is that a lot of those yoga teachers, especially in California, they somehow heard about Yogananda or reference him. And imagine this kind of, he basically brought yoga really from India to the West. And now California is this kind of place that is known for yoga, for people being spiritual. I mean, not only, but a lot of this kind of movement originates from there. And I can't help but think that this is like Yogananda having a big impact on this place. Am I wrong, you think?
Yeah, definitely, because like go to lots of yoga studios and there's always a small bookshelf, and Autobiography of Yogi is usually you know, one of the books on there that's been heavily used.
Well, what's pop quiz is one of Priyank's pop quiz. What does yoga mean? What does yoga actually mean?
Well, I know.
Go on.
Union, right? Yoga means union. That's what I keep reading.
Union between which two bodies?
Well, my understanding of yoga is the union with God, essentially, isn't it? Union with,
So between you and your... God, I suppose. I was just referring to my physics. Union always between more than one body.
And there's, you know, people talk about yoga and they say, oh, that's yoga, whenever they're doing the poses of yoga. But my understanding of yoga is that it encompasses the asana yoga, which is the physical posture type yoga. That people refer to commonly as yoga, but then meditation and devotion. There's like the trifecta of three ways of inclusive action of yoga. Is that right? Do you guys have a similar understanding of it?
Yeah,
absolutely. And I feel like the body is the, there's like different things that keep you from this union with God, right? And the body is one of them. And I feel like Hatha Yoga is one of the ways to get like perfect control of your body.
So the Eightfold Path of Yoga, as taught by Patanjali and is also in our SRF teachings, there's Yama and Niyama, which is the do's and don'ts. And then there's the Asana, which is the third step, which is right posture. There's Pranayama, which is control of prana or the subtle life currents in the body, the fourth step. Fifth step is Pratyahara, which is the interiorization of consciousness through withdrawal of the senses from external objects. Then there is dharana, which is focused concentration, holding the mind to one's thought or object. Then there's dhyana, which is meditation or absorption in the vast perception of God in his infinite aspects, bliss, peace, cosmic light, cosmic sound, love, wisdom, etc., all pervading throughout the whole universe. And finally, the eighth, it is samadhi, superconscious experience of a union of the individualized soul with cosmic spirit.
Which of those eight do you think is more prevalent in the world today?
Generally, people follow the morality, don't they? People usually live by yama and niyama, by moral codes, and they generally people don't look much further than that in terms of.
It's probably also to do with the ages that you are in, right? Like, I feel like only because we're in the beginning of the Dwapara Yuga, only now we start to have the vocabulary for energy and everything that happens in our bodies, right?
I'm gonna have to jump in and define the yugas, because people listening, you know, might not know what they are.
Oh man, we could have a whole podcast about yugas as well. We can quickly,
for research purposes.
The really good book to read is Sriyukteswar's Holy Science, which is really great. But basically, there's like four yugas that go in cycles, and it's like the lowest yuga is the Kali Yuga, that is like for 1,200 years, I think. Then the Dwapara Yuga, 2,400 years. Then the Treta Yuga, 3,600 years. And then the Satya Yuga, which is 4,800 years. And then it goes, the same amount of time, it goes down descending again. And right now we are ascending. We are about, where are we? 321 Dwapara, kind of. That, I think that's what Sriyukteswar says. It was. Dwapara Yuga started in the year 1700, I think he said.
Yeah.
And Dwapara Yuga is like supposed to be the age of energy. Yeah. And that's like Guruji often calls it the atomic age. It's the age where we start understanding life force, and I hope a whole lot more as well. We're just at the beginning of it.
Yeah. So that's the age of like Einsteinian thinking of going from matter to energy. That's really good. You're pulling out knowledge there, Mike. Well done. you had that on the tip of your tongue.
Oh, for sure, man.
There's a lot of controversy surrounding which yuga and how long the yugas are in.
That is correct.
Sriyukteswar very elegantly talks about why there's miscalculations. There's lots of scholars, for example, believe that each yuga is hundreds of thousands of years long, and the cycle is millions of years, which scientifically, you know, I'm from a very scientific background, it makes virtually no sense. Because like, you know, you talk about the history and like the history of the planet and us as a species, the cycles that Mike just, enunciated, and what's in the Holy Science, and they make much more sense because they coincide. For example, the Kali Yuga was supposed to have started at the end of Krishna's passing from this world. And so that's when it started. And if you think about it, say that was 4,000 years ago, and then it lasted to, you know, up to the last 300 years ago. Look at the darkness that we've had, you know, people, in terms of like how history and how, you know, the world has developed mainly from feudalism and wars and, you know, kingdoms and, you know, up to the present. Yeah, exactly right. And we can go into that, but let's not. That's a big topic.
Yeah, it is, definitely. Let's instead talk about Bikram Chowdhury. I hope I'm not butchering his name. Who is then appearing quickly, and he's saying, "Who am I? Who are you? Why we came to this earth as a human?" And let's talk about him a little bit. Did a little bit of research. Like, he was born in 1944. He's a yoga teacher, and everybody knows Bikram Yoga, right? Which is known for to be this hot yoga where you go into this room that where it has like 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and you're sweating, and then you do all the yoga poses there. That's as much as I knew about him. What do you guys think of him?
Yeah, well, it's quite controversial, really. I think just to touch on it, maybe people have watched a documentary on Netflix that goes into it in quite good detail. I haven't researched it myself, but certainly from this documentary, there's lots of allegations surrounding this yoga instructor, whereby he might have taking advantage of his position within the yoga world within Los Angeles, and maybe sexually harass people. So there's lots of issues there, which are alleged. But I think he fled the country of the U.S. and he's somewhere else. So I think there's lots of controversy, unfortunately, about this man. But yeah, I just know him through doing the Bikram yoga stuff. I've only done it once and I've never sweated so much in my life. And I don't, to be honest, I don't even know how healthy that is, because you're, especially with COVID and stuff now, you know, you're in a room with minimum 10 people, say everybody's got like 2 liters of water and it's empty by the time you're done and it's basically on the floor through sweat. So yeah, I don't really vouch for it. I think it's just one of these things that, over the years, like yoga has come from the east to the west and it's just mutated in so many ways. In my opinion, this is probably just one of them. That's all I have to say on the matter.
Is it that because of the warm temperature, you become a bit more flexible? I'm not sure if that's true. I did Bikram yoga a few times only. I always liked it. I mean, it is a bit of a sweaty experience, but afterwards I felt great.
It's meant to be good for the muscles. They relax, they stretch more, you can sit in poses for longer, you know.
And I think any yoga studio that wants to do hot yoga, they are allowed to call it Bikram yoga. I think he tried to copyright it, but it didn't really work out. So I've seen it like everywhere, even like here in Vienna there's like Bikram yoga classes. So
I just know there's like I can't remember, somebody within my circle was saying, have you done it was a type of, I can't remember the name for life of me, I can't remember the name, but they were essentially in harnesses. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of flying around as if it's some kind of like acrobatics with yoga. So yeah, there's so many different deviations of yoga and all that. I'll stick to the ones I know no interest. Thanks. There was something actually on this point, not to veer away from Bikram too much himself, but I think at one point, I think it was Sadhguru talked about this, that many, many years ago, there were so many deviations of yoga in India, and it devolved into so many different factions that eventually kind of collapsed or something happened. Do either of you guys know that story?
No.
And it took a long time for it to then go through different cycles of hundreds of years. Yoga's, you know, many thousands of years old. So I think maybe we're seeing this in you know, real time. There's so many different breakdowns of yoga that's happening right in front of our eyes.
Interestingly, in the book, something you won't know, he was born in Calcutta in 1946, but Bikram Chowdhury began Hatha Yoga at the age of 4. With one of India's renowned physical culturists, Bishnu Ghosh, who was the younger brother of Paramahansa Yogananda.
Oh, wow.
So therein probably is the link as to why he's in this film. And he's quite cool, isn't he? He's saying what he said in the white background, and he's not bothered about correct English. He's saying you are, who I am, you know, not correct, but he's not bothered about grammar and all those kind of things. He's just speaking as if, you know, as if he's speaking to his friend next to him. It's quite a nice image of him with a hat and stuff. Looking up at the camera.
Passionate. Sure.
Cool. So should we move on there? Yep. Then there's a lady speaking. She's saying, it's really very easy to get lost in the complexity of life. Have we figured out what her name is?
Yes, I have. Wow. It's in the book. Her name is Li Miao Seng. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly, but she is a devotee of Yogananda from Hong Kong. Li Miao was part of the team that helped to translate Autobiography of a Yogi into Chinese. And this little clip of her is so nice, isn't it? Because it's definitely not scripted, isn't it? Because she gets really overwhelmed with emotion in saying those words that Michael just said, and you can see her tearing up. It's quite beautiful, isn't it? It's like she kind of encapsulates the yearning of a devotee to to get out of this existence that causes so much pain and suffering. And she encapsulated it so beautifully in those just two or three words that she says.
Yeah, very moving. And then we can move on to the last person. He's talking a bit longer, so he's talking longer than the minute lasts, but we can talk about him a little bit. His name is Francis Clooney, and he is a professor at Harvard, right? I think it's called the Harvard School of Divinity. And it seems to be a non-denominational school, which is interesting. I didn't know this is how it worked, but what do we know about him?
Preempt my.
Yes, I can read what's in the
book. Oh, yeah, sure.
Like Francis Clooney, S.J. He's a Jesuit priest. Francis Clooney sits on the faculty of the Harvard Divinity School. How cool does that sound? As a professor in the developing field of comparative theology. He has studied the Sanskrit and Tamil traditions of Hindu India and has also written favorable commentaries on Yogananda's interpretations of the Christian Gospels. How cool does he look? I mean, that, you know, it's interesting. Like I did the opposite of what Steve Jobs preached, and I just did the safe career in engineering. It was like preordained, like Indians, you know, you either become a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer or whatever. Anyway, so if I hadn't have done that and if I'd just followed my passion, I really wanted to study Eastern philosophy and this course that he runs and his faculty, that literally would have been my dream scenario. And just like looking at him just brings back so many feelings for me because like, and then how he speaks, because like, I would have loved that course so much.
He looks a little bit like Steve Jobs. He's got his black polo neck. He's got these the similar glasses, similar beard. He's going for Steve Jobs look.
It's interesting that he's a Jesuit priest as well, right? I think Jesuits, they are known for this kind of simple living, high thinking, helping the poor approach to Christianity, like a more of a hardcore approach, I would say, which I quite like. Like Pope Francis, for example, has been a Jesuit as well. And I feel like he brought a good energy to the Vatican. And I love that someone like him, who seems to be so Christian that he's even a Jesuit, then goes on and starts teaching about Hinduism at Harvard. I quite like the openness of that thought, you know?
Yeah, it highlights the underlying unity of religion, or spiritualism in general.
So he says we're conflicted beings as humans. One of the deepest things about us is that our lives don't make sense except in the mystery. And yeah, it's so powerful. He says it and it kind of stirs my soul just as his words and just what he's saying. Like, and it's interesting that what you said, Mike, about Jesuits, and also the fact that he's written very favorably about Yogananda's commentary on the Gospels, which is obviously the second coming of Christ, right? We were just talking about that in our recent meeting, weren't we, Mike? And we just had Easter, and which sections we were talking about. We're talking about, for example, one that really moved me, that we're talking about how, like, on his final minute before his passing, or before he was before Jesus was killed on the cross, he said, "Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" And we had a really nice discussion about what that would mean because obviously Jesus is not not an ordinary soul. He's like he's an avatar, so he's like one of the highest beings that can be born again in a state of realization. So if a being such as Christ is doubting God's existence, then what of us? But what we discussed at the meeting was that that's how strong the pull and the draw of Maya is, or cosmic delusion, that a being as great as Jesus Christ can for a second, for a fraction of a second, because obviously he corrected his thinking and he resurrected himself later on. For a fraction of a second, he you know, questioned the existence or the morality of his father, which I think for me is such a so comforting, because how hard are we on ourselves, right, when we don't do our practices or we get angry or like anything that we're disappointed with, how hard are we on ourselves? But we have to remember that, you know, cosmic delusion is that strong and that powerful, and we just have to keep trying, right? We can't be our own worst enemies. We have to be our own best friends.
That's right.
And encourage yourself, right?
For sure.
I don't really think life made sense to me at all until the mysteries kind of came into my life. So, you know, I totally agree with what this man's saying, with what you're saying, Priya. Like, you know, it's funny because I didn't really get into this spirituality until, 5 years ago, maybe, 4 or 5. And, you know, reading books on spiritualism, I just couldn't put the books down. You know, not just Yogananda's books. There's other interesting literature out there. And I think I've spent my whole life not really, you know, having pieces of the puzzle missing. Of sorts, and this just puts it together for me. So I totally agree with you. Like when he said this about the mysteries, it just, you know, because, you know, there's chills up my spine kind of thing, and I totally see where he's coming from.
Yeah, I agree. Like I had an interesting discussion with a friend recently who told me that he's a little bit into spirituality, and then we were like, okay, so the first two things that came to my mind is like, do you believe in karma and do you believe in reincarnation? Because those are like two concepts. If you don't take them as given, then life becomes very different. All the incentives in life are so different, right? Mm-hmm. Then it's like, if there isn't reincarnation, then basically you have this one life. And then people often feel like in this one life, I want to have the best life I can have. You know, I need to eat all the good foods and I need to travel to all the good countries and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Overindulgence. Yeah.
Yeah. And then if you think about what karma and reincarnation means, then life becomes a school, right? And you keep coming back here until you do it correctly, kind of.
Yeah.
And that I feel like this, when once you have this kind of mindset, then it changes everything. And that's, I think, what he means by it makes no sense otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, to put a different spin on what Mike just said, one of my friends, who's not a devotee of SRF, but a different path, she said, although she is a Hindu, she said, "Oh, Priyanka, I don't want to come back here. So all my desires that I'm going to fulfill, all my desires that I've got, I don't want to come back to fulfill them." And I was like, that doesn't really sound like what that philosophy really would mean. Like we all need to like relinquish those desires because they're not true desires. They're like desires of the ego consciousness, right? And one desire begets another desire, begets another desire. You have to go back within and, you know, fulfill your soul's ambition to, you know, to connect your soul and to God, right? Not to fulfill all your mundane desires in this physical creation, of which are limitless, pretty much.
Yeah, I think when I heard him say that for the first time, and just hearing him say that again about the mysteries, it reminds me of occultism secret mystery schools, as they're called. And it's something that I'm super interested in, and a complete side note. But imagine over the years, you know, it's coming through these different yugas and, you know, having certain mentality about us as humans, spiritualism, you know, and all this conversation that we're having right now, we can't take for granted that at one time that was acceptable. It's acceptable now to talk about these things in public, but once upon a time, it wasn't so much, and maybe in certain places in the world, it isn't so much. So it's really cool just to have the opportunity to even speak about these mysteries and speak about spiritualism, spirituality, and reincarnation, and these things openly without persecution and all the rest of it. Just like a complete side note, when he that word mysteries just strikes him like a match within me, you know, and it just gets me super excited, you know, which is what like Yogananda and the SRF does. We're really, really lucky and blessed to be able to even have the conversations, I think.
Yeah, well, 300 years ago, before the advent of, you know, before we entered Dwapara Yuga, people were getting burnt at the stake. You know, anyone that saw Divine Mother in nature or anyone that experienced anything that was mystical, they would say, oh, that's witchcraft, that's paganism, whatever, and they would be burnt at the stake, right? And look where, from where we are there to where we are now, it's just, you're absolutely right, Chris. We're blessed to be where we are and to experience what we're experiencing and to be able to share and commune as we are.
Yeah, even on this medium, you know, who knows who listens to it, but it could be a door into a new life, you know. And we've been through a hard time, like in terms of, you know, the European side of things. There's been a lot of persecution, just like you said, you know, with witchcraft and things like this. But, you know, the persecution of Jesus and Jesus's followers and, you know, the attempt, because at the time, you have to remember, Jesus was essentially going against the power structure of the Roman Empire. You know, if you didn't fall in line, and you know, if you're trying to claim that you're the king, you're the son of God, but no, we already have that in the emperor or something. Like, yeah, we should really be thankful and grateful that we can have such open discourse. So,
absolutely. All right, I think this wraps up minute five. Is there anything else we want to talk about?
That's it for me.
No, good for me.
All right, then thank you all for joining.
Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.
See you next time.